I would like to welcome Elizabeth Oster. She is an archaeologist. She's working on the San Miguel Chapel Preservation Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte, and thanks very much for having me here today.
It's great to have you. The San Miguel Chapel here in Santa Fe, first of all, where is it and what's its historic significance?
The San Miguel Chapel is on the old Santa Fe Trail and a destination that will help a lot of Santa Fecinos located immediately. This sounds funny to say it this way, but it's on the same side of the street as the Upper Crust pizza parlor and directly across DeVarga Street from them. So it's
so
in the historic center.
So food being the most important thing there is, everybody now knows.
That's right. There are some other historic buildings nearby I feel I should mention, but that's definitely a major destination.
So what is the significance of it? Do we know how old it is, when it was built, who built it?
Well, the chapel was built by some of the first residents of Santa Fe. The current chapel actually had to be rebuilt after the Pueblo Indian Revolt of 1680. So one of the projects underway, or I should say one of the research programs that's underway as part of the San Miguel Preservation Project, is really understanding the construction history of the current building, as well as exactly what happened, what was built, what might have been burned otherwise destroyed during the Pueblo Indian Revolt of 1680. But it's one of Santa Fe's earliest places of worship. The chapel that would be earlier would have been La Castrense, which was located closer to the Santa Fe Plaza. And then, of course, Santa Feans will also know the location of St. Francis Cathedral, which comes along, of course, later in time. But the history that's been basically received and accepted through time is that it was built by some of the first Native American residents of Santa Fe, but these people were not simply local Pueblo Indians who may have been folks who supported or accepted the Spanish cause, but rather Native Americans that were actually brought by the Spanish with them from Mexico. So
Tlaxcaltecan Indians, something like that?
Well,
is what the tradition says.
The tradition says that they were, and the way you say this is Tlaxcaltecan. So in their language, which is still spoken by many people in Mexico today, that is the language of Nahuatl. And in that language, the X is always spoken with a soft sh sound. So literally, Mexico, which comes from that language, it's from a rival group, actually. The great rival group of the Tlaxcaltecans would have been the Mexica. We know the Mexica today as the Aztecs. That's how we refer to them. But the Mexica were the dominant people in central Mexico at the time of the Spanish conquest in 1519, and in fact were the bitter enemies of the Tlaxcaltecan people. In any event, we were talking about language, and one other thing I want to say before we get away from Nahuatl is that that language was spoken when the Spanish arrived. They had priests who very quickly learned how to speak it.
And actually,
in central Mexico, priests that arrived with the Spanish studied the language and then created these wonderful dictionaries and also works that are really ethnohistoric and even anthropological in nature. They wrote down many texts about what people were like, what languages they spoke, what their traditions were, and what the Spanish did, which was very clever, is people in central Mexico at the time were literate. So they had scribes, people who were highly trained, who were writing in their native language. And so they taught those individuals Spanish. And then they used the Spanish lexicon, basically, to transcribe text in Nahuatl. And then produced incredible documents. In fact, one of the most interesting is a document that has the Spanish text and the Nahuatl side by side. So it's very interesting to look at that because you can see how differently things might have been phrased and posed. But that's the Codex Florentino, actually. Anyway, we have lots of written information, which makes the next part of what we wanted to talk about interesting, because the Spanish had a real genius for documenting. They made this great effort to learn the native languages. Nahuatl wasn't the only language that they did this kind of work with. And they also had a real genius, a real passion. you might say, for writing things down, for documenting events, for describing expeditions. There were chronicles, there were memorias. When Juan de Oñate came north in 1598, he had an actual contract that specified exactly who would be with him and what they were bringing and what kind of honors they would receive, all sorts of information like that. So there's lots of wonderful written information. Some of that's straight history, some of it's what people would refer to as ethnohistory, so those are different sorts of accounts. Those might be legal records or pictorial documents. But we don't have anything in writing that definitely says that the Tlaxcaltecan people were there with Juan de Oñate, and we're here in Santa Fe, I should say, in 1598. And so that's my research interest, and that's what we're investigating.
So how did the mythology come down that they were here and that they built the San Miguel Chapel? Because that's what we're really talking about.
I think that there are two reasons. I think that there are some documentary references, and one that we were looking at just a little bit ago today is the Urrutia map of what Santa Fe, downtown Santa Fe, the historic core of Santa Fe, would have looked like in 1766. And that map actually shows the location of the San Miguel Chapel, and it shows has a code that shows the Barrio de Analco, and it states that it was occupied by Tlaxcaltecan Indians who had come up from Mexico. And so that would have been 18th century, which of course is somewhat later in time than the origin of the chapel and the origins of modern day Santa Fe. But we've got that reference. We have a reference from a 1580s expedition, the Espejo expedition, which mentions a Tlaxcalan individual. He's referred to as Gregorio de Tlaxcala. And his famous moment occurred because he knew how to carve gun stocks for the firearms they were using in that era, the arquebuses, and they had broken them and needed to fix them, and he was able to carve them out of a very hard wood that they found locally called tornillo wood. And so it's just mentioned that way, Gregorio de Tlaxcala. I don't know what his other attributes might have made him such a noteworthy individual, but there are tag bits of references like that, and that's what we have. And so I think what's happened, probably there were documents, or very likely there were documents that were destroyed in the Pueblo Indian Revolt, because we do know that burning occurred and destruction occurred in various locations where that kind of information would have been stored. But I think that the Spanish themselves, and then I also think people in Santa Fe, including the Native American people, the so-called Mexican Indians, I think that they might have had reasons for even wanting to be considered Tlaxcaltecan. And that has to do with the conquest history of those people in particular. So what had happened, if we roll back to 1519, this is when Cortez is crossing. He comes in from the east. He's headed for central Mexico. He has heard of wealthy and powerful groups of people, descriptions of wealthy cities beyond imagining, that sort of thing. I mean, that would have been the high point of the great Aztec capital at Tenochtitlan, which is the roots of where Mexico City is today. So as he's going on his way, he's encountering Mexican Indians, various groups of people. And at that point in time, people were living in city-states. They had complex systems of government. Some had currency. They had writing. They had the arts of astronomy and architecture and mathematics. So we're talking about very culturally sophisticated peoples, and the Tlaxcaltecans were one such group.
And so people here thought it was a sign of status to be considered to be one of those?
That's right. But there's more to it than that. The Spanish actually fought with the Tlaxcaltecans and defeated them. And I'm simplifying, but the Tlaxcaltecans were quite impressed with this and decided to convert. So they allied themselves with the Spanish and accepted Christianity and baptism. And as a result, because they early on decided to be allies, they were, in many cases, noblemen were allowed to retain their titles, families were allowed to retain their names, they were allowed to retain their lands, and as a result, the dispersal and miscegenation that happened to so many other peoples in central Mexico and elsewhere as the conquest proceeded north didn't happen to them. So they actually fought alongside the Spanish. One of the most remarkable documents from the 16th century that we have, pre Juan de Oñate and the founding of Santa Fe, is a document that was written to document the Mixtone War of 1540. That occurred north of Guadalajara, to put it in present-day terms. And the document was prepared, it's a memoria de servicios. That's the kind of thing that the Spanish conquistadores would write up to prove to the crown that they had done noble works and should therefore be compensated with lands or titles or whatever they were asking for. And it was written by the secretary of a Tlaxcaltecan nobleman named Francisco de Acacitli, who had, he was Christian, and he had come forward, fought alongside the Spanish. He was recognized as a nobleman. He had his own staff, and he was writing all of this up. So this is who the Tlaxcaltecans were. They allied with the Spanish. They helped the Spanish defeat the Aztecs, their bitter enemies, the Mexica, and many other people. And so I think that there's just been this assumption, and it probably was current at the time and even current and continuing into centuries after the founding of Santa Fe, that the Tlaxcaltecan people were the friendly Indians.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore, they would be the ones that everybody would want to, you know, sort of culturally affiliate themselves with.
So historic preservation has been going on at the San Miguel Chapel for the last 40 years. You're an archaeologist. What do you actually do? What is the nature of preservation work?
Well, that's a big question.
I know.
And it has.
But you think of already archaeologists going it out into the into the, you know, open space and digging in the dirt, but you know, but here you are in a building that's been around for a while, and there's this, you know, you have to preserve it and discover things about it at the same time.
I think that that's one of the biggest challenges for archaeology in our era, actually, because in a different time, what you did as an archaeologist is you went out and you found things to survey and dig. And the survey, archaeological survey, is really recording and understanding how sites are distributed on the landscape. But excavation can be a very destructive process. So you do archaeology because you love it, but then when you do an excavation, the excavation itself can actually forever remove the physical remains of what it is that you're studying.
And take things out of context, as we've talked about on this show before. Once the context is removed, you lose so much of the knowledge.
Well, that's why you have to be absolutely spot on in terms of recording all of the information and context that you can. Very well you expressed it, that for archaeologists, it's not just that you pick up a projectile point, an arrowhead, or that you pick up a pottery shirt. It's where you found it, it's what was with it. All of that is really true.
So what happens at San Miguel Chapel?
Well, dealing with a building is really different, because the main goal of the project is the preservation of the building. And so all of the work that we do, whether it's the assessment and documentation of the preservation practices that have been, the different things that have been done to treat the building, or planning for the things that will be done to treat the building and the archaeology, all of those things have to work together. And in this era, trying to do work like that is really a new challenge for archaeology. I should say some of my colleagues feel that the discipline of historical archaeology, which is really kind of a new thing in archaeology, doesn't sometimes get enough attention or respect from, you know, sort of the standard archaeology mainstream. I have heard the term hysterical archaeologist applied, but that's
Heavens.
Another thing.
Yes.
But in this case, what we're really trying to do, I would say, is preservation archaeology. So the reason, if we do anything intrusive to the fabric of the building or to the cultural deposits that it holds, the goal will be to have as little disturbance as possible and to make sure that we are doing it sensitively, that it's done in consultation with culturally affiliated groups who have strong personal feelings and attachments and history with the structure and the stories that it symbolizes. And also that we will get the information that we need to gently treat it and hopefully preserve it. And something we were talking about a little bit earlier before the show began, but we asked the question, you know, what is all the preservation about, really? How do you decide what to preserve?
Well, I mean, this is something that I often wonder about is that kind of dialectic between, on the one hand, building new stuff, which means letting the old go, and then holding on to the old for reasons, and what those reasons are.
And what is just old junk?
Exactly.
What is old stuff that belongs in a landfill versus something that's really worth preserving? I think that one of the things that American archaeology has led the way in is really trying to make those assessments and to do them involving indigenous peoples. Now across the world today, it's under the aegis of the term repatriation, but many, many museum collections and preserved archaeological sites and districts and historic districts all over the world are beleaguered by claims from groups who say, well, this is our cultural patrimony. The Elgin marbles, for example, from the Parthenon, should they be in the British Museum of Anthropology, or should they be back at the Parthenon? Well, the short answer to that is that if they were at the Parthenon, they would have been blown up by the Turks. So the fact that we have them still has something to do with the fact they've been in a museum. But as we move into this millennium, one of the...
Where there's no more war and people blowing things up.
Yeah, we wish that were true. But one of the debates that we're involved in at present is really who owns the past and who gets to make those decisions. In the United States, we passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act in the 1990s. And since then, all museums, including museums in New Mexico that receive federal funds, have entered into consultations with Native American tribes about what they should preserve, if there's anything that should be repatriated. Sometimes it depends on the group, but sometimes people will say, well, we think it's fine for stuff to be in the collections, but we don't want you to put it on display. Or we think it's fine for it to be in the museum, but once a year we would like our shamans to be able to go in privately and perform a ritual. One time when I was working for the National Park Service, we were in the process of repatriating materials that were stored at the Western Archaeological Conservation Center to a number of groups here in New Mexico and Arizona. And at the time, I was with child. And a group was being assembled to go and look at the material and then make these sorts of decisions. And very considerately, I was told that I should not be part of that group because there might be some things in there that would be harmful for the baby.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was just an
And we're not talking about toxins. We're talking about something else.
Spiritual objects that I should not see.
Very interesting.
And so I think that what we're doing now is... We're moving into a new way of looking at all these things, and if they hadn't, this sounds like a funny way to say it, but we can now tell stories and talk to people that weren't necessarily asked for their opinion or asked about what they thought was important when American culture was in its early developing stages. And a really new and interesting thing is the fact that many different voices are now part of the dialogue and many different stories are being told. We all together have to decide what we think is worth preserving because it is expensive and it does tie up our resources. But it's also true that our cultural resources are limited and they're endangered. They're not things that will stay forever if we don't make the effort to preserve them. We just have to decide what we want that to be.
And so all of these are issues that spring from San Miguel Chapel, the humble San Miguel Chapel, which is on old Pecos Trail,
old
Santa Fe Trail near Upper Crust Pizza, where in this very location on Wednesday, June 25th at 12 noon, you and Jim Hare of Cornerstones, Elizabeth Oster, whom we're speaking with right now, and Jim Hare of Cornerstones, and Cornerstones is a wonderful New Mexico organization dedicated to preservation of this type, will be speaking. And unfortunately, it's time to go now, but just tell us briefly what you'll be speaking about.
I'll be talking more about the story thus far with respect to the Mexican Indians who came north with the Spanish and and help them in their early efforts to build the royal capital, La Villa Real de San del Santa Fe de San Francisco de Assis, which is the real name of Santa Fe. And I believe that Jim Hare will also be talking in more detail about the current program of research, what's happening now and what's planned for the future at San Miguel Chapel. I do think that a good way to end this is to just for all to know that one of the most interesting stories, and clearly one with aspects that we have not considered previously in Santa Fe, is really the story of the San Miguel Chapel.
Elizabeth Oster is an archaeologist working on the San Miguel Chapel Preservation Project, along with an organization called Cornerstones. And once again, you can go to seastones.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.